Ian, I have to tell you, because we're full disclosure on this show, you should have seen Steve Dangle's face when the Cody CeCe contract was official. What was your face like when you heard CeCe's deal?
It wasn't very positive, and it's funny. I was actually helping out J.D. Bunkus the other day, filling in for Ben Ennis, helping out. We had Cody.
I'm not familiar
on the phone.
With that name, Ian. I don't know. Yeah, anyway, sorry, I'm just.
I don't know who he is either. It's some stranger, but he. We decided, okay, let's ask Cody CeCe some interesting questions here, and I asked him, "Have you talked to Mike Babcock? Have you talked to Kyle Dubas? And where do they foresee you playing in the lineup?" And they said, "Oh, you know, with either Morgan Riley or with Jake Muzzin." And it feels to me like they see value in Cody CeCe's game, and they plan on playing him in the top four at least until Travis Dermott gets back. It just got announced that there are no signing bonuses in the deal. So the theory that maybe you would heavily put a bunch of signing bonuses in it right away, where you're paying 90% of the contract up front, and then maybe you offload him later in the year to a team who is willing to take on very little salary at a high cap hit, that theory's gone. So it looks like the plan here is to play Cody CeCe on the Leafs this year, if not for the whole year, at least for half the season, I would have to think. I'm not sure what to make of it, because personally, I don't think Cody CeCe is a very good defenseman. Maybe they think he's the best right-handed option out there who can fill maybe a bottom pairing role and some more sheltered minutes, but I'm having a lot of difficulty finding an optimistic take on this one, because I think they would have been better off trying to get to arbitration and then just moving on from Cody CeCe altogether.
So, okay, I'm going to force you to try to find a positive, because at this point, he's a Toronto Maple Leaf for the foreseeable future. So we kind of, sort of have to. Here's what I can't get past, man, and you're very analytically inclined. You know lots of stuff. You speak numbers better than the alphabet. How did the largest front office in hockey, not just the largest front office, the largest analytics department in the sport, acquire this guy and then retain him? What is there? What redeeming factor do you see when you take a little deep dive there?
I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on right now and give you a theory that might make sense. So
throw it on.
Let's say they knew that trading Zaitsev was going to bring back negative value and you had to take on a bad contract, regardless of who you were trading him to, you know, and maybe it was a contract with 2 years of term on it. You don't like that. Well, hey, here's Cody CeCe. He's going to have 1 year of term on him. He can sign his qualifying offer at $4.3 million, and he can basically say, I'm going to be on the Leafs whether or not you want me to be there. So by the Leafs bringing him in and saying, okay, we're going to give you $4.5 million, maybe to other teams that tells them that you see value in Cody CeCe. This is a guy who teams were offering Jonathan Drouin for a few years ago, Matt Duchene. He was the centerpiece in a Taylor Hall trade, reportedly. So this is a player who very recently had high value around the league, and it seems to have finally dropped off to more where I think his actual talent level is when it comes to his impact on the game. But maybe they think they can rehabilitate his value by playing him in the top four in some more sheltered minutes. Because you have to remember, in Ottawa, he played tough minutes with Dion Phaneuf. And with the forwards that they have there, that's not a position to succeed. So I know that I'm a numbers-heavy guy, but I do think that sometimes when a player is playing ridiculously tough minutes, sometimes there's just no situation to succeed. And we saw it in Toronto, where if you give a player the opposite, you give them the cushy JVR usage, you can put them in a very solid position to succeed, to the point where JVR's defensive numbers looked very good. I'm not sure if you've watched JVR play, but he's obviously not a very good defensive player. So maybe there's an argument to be made that if you shelter a player properly, you can inflate their value. And the opposite with Cody CeCe is that when he was put in extremely tough context, he didn't perform well in those minutes. So maybe the idea here is that you had to take on a bad contract, regardless of who you traded Zaitsev for. So you figured, okay, screw it. Let's bring Cody CeCe in for 1 year. We'll try to rehabilitate his value. We're obviously not going to get a good asset for him in return, but can we turn him into a player that we get an asset for, whether it's a draft pick, a young player, a roster player? Maybe that's the play here. I'm not sure. But if the plan is to play him 82 games, I'm concerned that Mike Babcock's going to play him in the top four, much like he did with Ron Hainsey and Nikita Zaitsev over the last few years. And I know that you know that I'm a huge Travis Dermott truther. I think that he is already a top four NHL defenseman who is yet to be played there. So if this means more games for Travis Dermott on the bottom pairing and Cody CeCe in the top four, I'm not a fan of it. So I guess the best way you can talk yourself into it is that the Leafs see Cody CeCe as a player that they can rehabilitate his value in easier minutes, play him alongside a great player in Riley or Muzzin, and then trade him to another team and get some kind of asset return. That would be my best positive spin on this, and I'm not sure how much I believe that.
I'm looking forward to pulling my hair out by the roots this season. Ian, okay, listen. So prior to this trade, well, I guess this trade happened before Tyson Barrie came on board. We know Tyson Barrie's the top right-handed shot on this team. He's the best one. If the Leafs don't have CeCe, let's say they do that thing where they completely walk away from him, which we now know is a fantasy scenario. Who the heck plays for this team on the right side? And I'm going to put an asterisk on this fantasy scenario for you. You can't say Justin Hall. You cannot. Mike Babcock is not going to play that player regularly this season. So who would it have been for you if not Cody CeCe?
So if we're living in a reality where I don't have to pay Cody CeCe $4.5 million and I can choose to not pay him and then pay him $0 and go with a different defenseman, I would say that a replacement level defenseman at the league minimum at $700,000 is very similar to what Cody CeCe is going to provide you at $4.5 million. So Oof. Is it worth the $3.8 million boost to get Cody CeCe to provide a little bit of extra value? Or could you have had some kind of replacement-level defenseman, whether it's an Alex Petrovich on the open market, or whether it's Martin Marincin playing with Riley again, because we loved that pairing back in the day.
No.
Some kind of league-minimum defenseman, can you use that $3.8 million of surplus cap space to address some other needs? Could you have used it to bring in a Corey Perry? Are there maybe some forwards you could look at? Is there a center on the market who could provide more value than a Jason Spezza? I think there's an argument to be made that even though you might not be able to find a better right-handed defenseman, I think you can use that cap space in a better way. But the reality is Cody CeCe is going to be on the Leafs next year. So let's see what kind of value he can provide. I'm very skeptical that he's much of anything. But if you give him more sheltered minutes and much better teammates, which he didn't have in Ottawa, I think there's an avenue where he's at least playable in your top four. He's obviously going to be your weakest defenseman there, but maybe you don't get eaten alive at even strength, and then you have a Muzzin-Barrie pairing that absolutely dominates at 5-on-5.
Ian Tulloch from The Athletic joining us here on Sportsnet Today. Stephen George, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We asked the callers earlier in the week, Ian, when we heard about the Cody CeCe deal, is the Leafs' blue line better today than it was in Game 7 in Boston? And I'm not talking about injuries, I'm just talking about on paper.
That's the funny thing, because on paper, if you have a healthy Jake Gardner and a healthy Travis Dermott, I would argue that Leafs defense was actually very strong last year.
Way better.
You just really never got to see it. Those players were never all healthy at the same time. Jake Gardner had back issues. Travis Dermott went down. Muzzin and Zaitsev developed some strong chemistry on a shutdown minutes pairing. So if everyone was healthy, I'd say that Leafs blue line would be better last year than it is this year. But the fact of the matter is that Gardner was very weak in the playoffs because of his back injury. Travis Dermott could barely complete a breakout pass, and we know that that's not very much like him. So I do think it's an improved defense from what they had in the playoffs. I think Tyson Barrie on the right side gives you so much more flexibility on your breakouts. The Leafs were so easy to game plan against in the playoffs. Just send your entire forecheck to their left-handed defenseman, they're going to force the right-side defenseman to move it, and you're not too worried about Ron Hainsey and Nikita Zaitsev making breakout passes. Now with Tyson Barrie on the right side, and in a perfect world, Travis Dermott on the right side in the top four in a few months, you have a lot more balance. I'm not sure if we're going to get that. Maybe it's Cody CeCe in the top four the rest of the way, but you do have more balance on the breakouts, and I think that raises the ceiling of this team in the playoffs. And at the end of the day, the playoffs are the only games that matter, right? So if this team gets through the regular season, I'd argue that they are better built for playoff success with their current roster than they were in Game 7 of last year when we consider the Gardner and Dermott injuries.
We'll see what actually happens. Survey says CeCe wins the Norris. We all know that's going to happen. Moving on from him, moving on from the Leafs defense entirely, there's the issue of, okay, Kerfoot's out of the way. That's wonderful. He was an RFA. CeCe's out of the way. That's wonderful. He was an RFA. There is one pretty big name left, and that's Mitch Marner. And I'm struggling to figure out how the heck he's going to fit under the cap. Now, a lot of people harass cap-friendly with tweets. I text them. I text them directly. So here's what they said that was very interesting to me, because everyone's freaking out. I think there's about $9.4 million after Nathan Horton is added to LTIR. to sign Mitch Marner. But based on this text that we had a little while back, I'm not sure that's actually true. He said, the way the league determines who counts against the summer cap is different from the regular season. For example, even though Marner isn't signed, he counts against their cap for around $900,000, so close to $1 million. Same thing for a guy like Rosen. Obviously, this conversation was before he was traded. He counts for a percentage of their cap because he played four games with them last season. So they have more space, but there are also a few guys who count that probably won't count when the puck drops on October 2nd. So I say all that to say this. What is your drop dead number? I'm going to walk away from him. I'm going to trade him for Mitch Marner.
It's funny. I think we talked about this, I want to say a month ago when I was on your podcast trying to discuss this Mitch Marner fiasco. I want to say that the crazy numbers have come down a little bit. We're not in the $13, $14 million range because those numbers were always absurd to begin with.
It's never going
to
happen.
The Sebastian Aho offer sheet has kind of, I don't want to say reset the market, but I think it's reset people's expectations of what Marner can realistically get in the current RFA landscape. I feel like Braden Point is going to sign a well below market contract in Tampa Bay based on the history there. So I feel like all these comparables are going to indicate that Marner's not going to get double digits on his next salary. I don't think he's going to get anywhere in the $10 million range, although he could leverage an offer sheet for, let's say, 5 years at $10.5 million, because that's a situation where the Leafs would have to match. It's the compensation tier is two first-round picks, a second-round pick, and a third-round pick. And even though $10 million or $10.5 million isn't ideal for paying Mitch Marner, I think at that tier, if the offer sheet threat is real, you have to pay him that even though you're not happy about it. So my absolute drop-dead number is probably $10.5 million, but I'm not happy with that in the least. I think the Leafs can negotiate something in the to high $9 million range on a long-term deal. Maybe the best way this gets resolved is on a bridge deal. But then again, the bridge deal numbers we're hearing are 3 years around $8 million. I don't think that's comparable at all to what Kucherov Panarin signed a two-year deal at $6 million. Kucherov a three-year deal at $4.8 million. So Marner on a bridge deal in the current cap should probably be closer on a three-year deal to about $7 million. And I'm not sure if his camp ever gets there. So where do we arrive at the end of this? I think at the end of the day, Marner signs a long-term deal somewhere at least in the six-year range, in the nine-ish million-dollar range, and then maybe we can get through all this craziness. I know it's been a fun summer, but at the end of the day, it feels like he wants to be a Leaf. He's going to be paid fairly relative to the market, and even though I think there's an argument to be made that star young players like Aho and like Point and like Marner deserve much more money than they're currently being paid, when you look at it relative to the league, I don't think he's getting anywhere north of $10 million. So I'm going to say somewhere in the nine-ish million dollar range.
Ian, is a bridge deal really not an option if you're the Maple Leafs? Maybe it's better to swallow some of the cap hell now, but in 2, 3, 4 years from now when the cap is apparently going up, that Marner contract is going to look a lot better. I don't want to be paying Mitch Marner in 3 years potentially $13 to $14 million because his salary will raise just like the cap will raise. Is there any way a bridge deal works for the Maple Leafs? And if you're Kyle Dubas, why the hell would you only want to sign him for 3 years? I thought the Matthews contract was a mistake at only 5 years. It can't be only 3 years for Mitch, right?
The problem with the Matthews deal being 5 years is that he's able to walk as an unrestricted free agent at that point. And I know that there are all these the Arizona Coyotes rumors that he'll want to go home. With Mitch Marner, hypothetically, if you were to sign him to a three-year deal, he would at least be a restricted free agent at the end of that. So he would at least have his rights and be able to negotiate a contract with him where he can't negotiate with 31 other teams. Whereas when Matthews is a free agent in 5 years, he's going to be able to negotiate with 31 teams, and that's going to increase his ask. So There's an argument to be made that if this is a year of cap hell that you just absolutely can't avoid without a bridge deal, then a bridge deal can be a parachute, last resort option. But I agree with you. I think that if you're the Maple Leafs, it makes more sense to lock Mitch Marner up to at least 5 or 6 years, because even though it'll cost you a bit more money now, in 3, 4, 5 years, when this team should still be a contender with the cheap young talent they have, Mitch Marner is going to be worth a lot more. So if you have him on a $9 million contract, or let's say a $9.5 million contract, in 4 years, that's going to look really good. I know everyone complains about the William Nylander contract. How good does it look now that Kevin Hayes is signing for 7 years, $7 million? And you'd much rather have William Nylander for less than that. So
it's going to look better when he puts up 60, 70 points.
Yeah, that's. I think he's going to have a strong year next year when he plays 82 games alongside Austin Matthews and maybe gets power play one time. So we'll see. But that's the thing with these long-term contracts. If you're a young player in your young 20s and you sign a long-term contract, it just looks better and better and better as the deal goes on. If you're signing a player in their late 20s or early 30s to a long-term deal, it just looks worse and worse and worse. And that's why when you're signing these cheap young players and you're signing these young superstars in your Matthews and your Nylanders and your Marners, you want to go for as long-term as humanly possible. And then the agent knows that. The agent knows that, hey, an 8-year deal is going to cost you big time. But if you're the Leafs, I think it makes sense to pay for the long-term deal because it's going to help you sustain a contending window that lasts longer than 2 or 3 years. I don't think you want a contending window in the next 2 or 3 years. I think you want a contending window of 4, 5, 6 years. You know, as long as Matthews is on your team and Tavares is on your team, you should be a contender. So I would try to get Marner on a long-term deal at a reasonable number because I think that's the best way to sustain success for Toronto. And at the end of the day, I do think that's where both sides arrive at. It's just, going to take a lot of finagling to get there, and we're going to have lots of fun talk radio to discuss it. So I'm glad that I'm here on July 4th talking about it. I'm probably going to be here on August 4th talking about it. It's going to be so much fun.
Well, we only have a minute left on this fun talk radio on July 4th. Listen, I feel like we spent so much of the past season complaining about just everything contract-wise, but eventually they're going to hit the ice and play games. What has you optimistic about this upcoming season?
It's funny, when the Tyson Barrie trade was first announced, I was a bit pessimistic because, as you know, I'm a very nerdy guy, and a lot of the really detailed analytics weren't very high on Barrie. I started diving more into his game and trying to understand why there was such a difference between the eye tests and the numbers, and I started to learn that, wow, when he plays with star players like MacKinnon, who can open up space for his dynamic offensive skill, I feel like it's more than the sum of two parts. I feel like when you play Tyson Barrie with a Mitch Marner or a William Nylander who can create space off the rush, Barrie has the dynamic talent to create offense and to consistently outperform what the shot metrics can say, what the analytics can say. So even though the analytics might see him as more of a number four defenseman, I think there's an argument to be made that he could be a solid number three or number two. And that's the best right-handed defenseman the Leafs have had in at least the last decade, maybe longer, I'd argue, in the salary cap era. So I'm looking forward to seeing how Tyson Barrie fits in with this dynamic, young, skilled team because I think his play style is going to lead to a lot of offense for Toronto.